Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 416. Friday, December 24th, 2021. Christmas Eve.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. Some of you know, some of you don't. I'm in Arkansas. I think most of you knew I was coming to Arkansas, but some of you are not following me on YouTube and probably don't know the details. Anyway, I'm in Arkansas. I now live at my mother's house, which was her mother's house. It's actually the house my mother grew up in. I'm here with Mocha. Mocha, my three-legged black cat. She's been with me for 16 years, and she's got that old cat wasting thing going on. She's skinnier and lighter every time I pick her up. But what you have here is a pretty long Sea Realm Vault podcast. The interview portion, edited down, is still a solid 90 minutes. So I won't say a whole lot here at the top of the program other than to say that my guest is Nicholas Lyons, and that he is, he'll introduce himself, and I probably couldn't do him justice without a printed bio at the ready, which I don't have on screen right now. What you're about to hear is our very first conversation. You know that the usual pattern is the conversation starts on the free Sea Realm podcast, and then, you know, somewhere after 45 minutes or an hour, I cut it off and say, well, if you want to hear the rest, it's on the vault. Well, here we're going in reverse order. Nick wanted to do an unrecorded, just get-to-know-you call, but having heard him on other shows, I was pretty certain that there'd be lots of good material in the get-to-know-you phone call that I would want to share with an audience, so I said, hey, let's split the difference, and we'll record it, and I'll share it with the small room, you know, the more intimate audience of the Sea Realm Vault listenership, and then, if we're happy with where that goes, we'll do another one for the big room later. So that's the plan. So here is the Get to Know You conversation with Nick Lyons. Hello.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Yep.
Okay. That sounds great. That's progress.
Are you not spending your whole life on Zoom like everybody else during the pandemic?
I do, but I use the mobile phone a lot and not the computer as much. But today I thought I would try to use the computer instead.
All right. Yeah, I don't like to do Zoom on the phone.
You have far less control.
I just don't like touch screens. I mean, it's okay if you get to the size of an iPad or something, but trying to like type a message or something on a smartphone is just, I want a keyboard.
That's true. That is exactly the truth.
But I'm a Gen Xer, so that's, you know.
Me too. Okay. How old are you?
I am 53.
I'm 53. I'm 48.
So I'm at near the start of Generation X.
Yeah. And your podcast and the, I read your on your website some background, and that you've been through an interesting journey.
And, yes.
And that informs your viewpoint. And then I tried to watch some of the or listen to some of the other podcasts, and I found that you can't get to it on iTunes on Apple.
Apple computer has been the enemy of the Sea Realm podcast since its inception.
Why is that?
I have no idea, but they just routinely removed my podcast from the iTunes listings. And every time they did that, you know, that it destroyed all of the positive reviews that people had left. And it is positive reviews largely which inform the algorithms, you know, where to share your podcast around. So
yeah,
no, Apple has been the sworn enemy of my podcast since day one. So it makes it tough.
Yeah, I know it is. Look, I don't know why those things happen. It could be, you know, random, or it could be that there is some sort of agenda, but it does seem that there is a too much of power in the hands of the platform operators and, you know, the algorithms that set them. And then you get this sort of plausible deniability as well, which is like, oh, you know, it's a giant system.
True. You know, it is a giant system. It's and true. A lot has to be done algorithmically. I've had a lot of trouble with the YouTube algorithms recently, in that part of my income comes from podcasting. Part of it comes from writing and drawing a comic strip for a political organization. And I found that it helps just to keep me honest about how many hours I'm actually working to live stream my drawing sessions.
That's cool.
But then people who know me from the podcast will tune in and chat at me and, you know, talk to each other in the chat. And if they say anything forbidden, like talking about COVID, that's a community guideline strike against me.
Right.
And sometimes these community guideline strikes come in many days after the offense. So at one point, I got two in rapid succession for things that happened many days ago. And if you get three, they delete your whole channel. Hundreds of videos would be destroyed. So I had to stop, you know, live streaming those drawing sessions for many months until all of those community guideline strikes fell off my account. But, you know, no human is probably involved in this. It's just the algorithms picking up on certain words and saying, oh, naughty, naughty, you can't talk about that. And, you know, thousands of hours of work creating hundreds of hours of video could be destroyed, you know, with the snap of a virtual finger, and no human is involved. It's just stupid algorithms expertly performing, perfectly performing the stupid instructions they've been given. So it's, yeah, it's infuriating.
This is exactly the problem, is that you can be deplatformed and there is so little recourse, there is so little way to defend yourself, and everything is at the end of the day subject to the end user license agreement. So whatever they say is law. you're on a corporate platform and they make the law, they enforce the law, and, you know, they really, unless you have a giant amount of power, you can't change that reality.
I'm sure you've seen videos of people who have printed out those user license agreements to show how long they are, like standing on top of buildings and letting all the connected pages unfold.
Yeah.
It is understood that nobody will ever read them.
Yes.
And that they're legally binding.
That's right. And that's in and of itself should be effectively prosecuted through either the courts or through legislation, that I believe that there's a legal terminology for creating documents that are intended to obscure and to essentially, you know, they are non-negotiable. So their term that, you know, your set terms, rather than you don't have any right to negotiate the EULA. All you have is the right to not use the service. But if everybody else is using the service, this is where the individual rights and the collective rights become such interesting subjects, which, you know, really is the basis for the next generation of the web that, you know, we call the Internet of Value. Some people would call Web 3 if they're in the Ethereum world, or, you know, people use these different nomenclature. But yeah, this is everything that's coming to us. And I think that there's very few generations that can bridge the comprehension of both of those worlds. A lot of people in the new world or the younger generations, they don't perceive a lot of these issues because they've never experienced a world without the intermediation of screens and EULAs.
Right. You know, we've jumped right into to good content, but for the sake of people listening in the future, who are you?
Well, you know, this is the thing. I read your background and you have such a, that, you know, who am I? That's a really good question. And I suppose the best answer is, I founded my company and it's called Archetype because it's from an understanding that we have many archetypes and that we are not just one thing. So the name that we're given is given to us by our parents. And so, you know, most people get the name and then start crafting their story, which becomes their history, I suppose, his story. And you sort of attribute experiences to your consciousness. And so if you are still in a world where you believe that you are your name, shall we say, then my name is Nicholas Lyons. I am English, living in Los Angeles, and have had the privilege of being able to experience a lot of different archetypal experiences. And those experiences have been in finance and in technology. And my interests are in the reconciliation of the natural sciences and the social sciences. And a particular individual by the name of E.O. Wilson wrote a book called Consilience, which is really all about reconciling the natural sciences and the social sciences and the unity of knowledge. And so, you know, the journey that I find myself on is a journey to learn as much as I can about as many things as I can and understand them such that, you know, I can live a more fulfilled life and be a better husband and father and son and all of these multiple roles that we play in life. And so you start with a very difficult question.
What do you like to be called?
Nick or Nicholas.
Okay.
Whichever you prefer. I don't mind.
Easy answer there. After 9/11, I feared that the United States would overreact to the attacks and that part of that overreaction would be a crackdown on civil liberties in the United States. And I decided to leave the country for a while. Uh-huh. And I wasn't gone for long, but I spent a lot of that time in Thailand and then in Australia. And I sold most of my books before I left. But one of the books that I kept with me and actually had in my check bag to read on, you know, in late nights in hotels and things when I couldn't sleep was Consilience, The Unity of Knowledge by E.O. Wilson. So that's a longtime favorite of mine. And my ears pricked up when you said Consilience in, I think it was a Clubhouse conversation, a recording of a Clubhouse conversation that Albert Bates directed me to on Twitter. Do you know who Albert Bates is?
I looked him up, but I don't know who he is. No, I don't know him.
Fair enough. There's a very, probably the most famous of the still existing hippie communes from the 60s and 70s is a place called The Farm in Summertown, Tennessee. And Albert Bates has, he manages a portion of The Farm called the Eco Village Training Center, which is about appropriate technologies, alternative building methodologies, organic agriculture, no-till agriculture, hippie stuff. But, you know, he's also a very early adopter of personal computers and no technophobe, you know, by any stretch. And when I was at a very low period in my life, Albert invited me to come and basically be the podcaster in residence at the Eco Village Training Center. So, and that was over a decade ago. And he's somebody that I've kind of lost touch with. And, you know, it's just the occasional pings on Twitter and places like that where we remind one another that we exist. But he's been very helpful to me. And he's somebody who is well known, I think, to most of the listeners of this podcast. So shout out and thanks to Albert Bates, who probably isn't hearing this. And I would invite him to join us on a conversation. But very wisely, he spends his winters in Holbox, Mexico, where they have very poor internet. So he doesn't have the bandwidth to join us by voice, I don't think.
I look forward to meeting or speaking to him when he's back on the farm.
If you go to Amazon and just search for his name, he's written many books and you can see the sorts of books that he's written. For a time, he and I and much of the audience and most of the guests that I talked to on this podcast were consumed by what I now consider to be a dark paranoid fantasy, and that is the notion that industrial society would soon be collapsing because of a lack of fossil fuel energy. That was around 2008, or I guess it was around 2007 when I started to get, you know, dabble with that notion. And then the financial catastrophes of 2008 really seemed to legitimize it, not just for me, but for a lot of people. Yeah. And so I lived, you know, in that world of this is all going to fall apart very soon. We need to make preparations. And then it didn't fall apart, you know. Right. And I, for a time was just, I was sort of doing the Millerite thing, now called the Seventh-day Adventists, of just, you know, advancing the prophesized date for the apocalypse, you know, pushing it forward into the future. And then I came to see the psychological elements at work, particularly when I saw people moving on from, you know, peak oil crash is coming, get ready, to human extinction is coming because of climate change, get ready. And it was just very clear to me that there's an underlying psychological need, which is informing, you know, the worldview or the choice of worldview. And right. I've possibly swung to the opposite extreme in that I'm not interested in anybody else's craziness. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be caught up in anybody's dark worldviews. And I understand that I'm probably filtering out too much. You know, I'm probably disregarding things with some validity, but I'm just not interested in being caught up in any dark mindset, which is a very strange position for me, a podcaster, to be in, particularly during this pandemic, because I'm just, you know, if you want to propagate an alternative narrative around COVID, Google will make it hard for you, Facebook will make it hard for you, Twitter will make it hard for you, but your audience will eat it up. And, you know, this a lot of careers are being made on propagating dark fantasies about COVID, and I'm just not interested. I'm beyond not interested. I'm repulsed by that.
I hear what you're saying, and I've been trying to analyze, you know, the mission of Consilience is to try to get towards the unity of knowledge. And that unity of knowledge is about trying to understand who we are. So I think the first thing is that we should sort of analyze, and this is, or this is where I've come to, and I've come through religious background, and I would say at some points in time have thought that I might be an atheist, and then I thought I might be an agnostic, and you come to realize that we are what Hofstadter called humans are meaning-seeking machines. And so if you understand that we're meaning-seeking, then you have to look and understand how we seek meaning for ourselves. And I think Hofstadter also says that the process that we go through is we see, if we have the benefit of our eyesight, we label, and then we judge, if you were to simplify it. So you're a meaning-seeking machine that sees, labels, and judges. And then we are optimizing for an outcome. And the optimization is that we seek pleasure and we try to avoid pain for the most part. And then obviously that is refined in thinking to becoming a fitness function. When people talk about evolution, and if you look at people who have interesting views on that, like Donald Hoffman, for example, and he talks about a conscious agent theorem, and he's extending evolutionary thought, and he talks about fitness versus truth. Now, when people think about fitness, they often think about physical fitness, but what it's really about is the fitness of the decision for the environment. And so if you want to be a highly successful human, you have to be extremely evolutionary in your thinking, which is to say that evolution is about adaptation. And so the fittest species adapts to the environment the most effectively. And therefore, what I believe happens to people who have a very fixed identity is that they don't update their a priori or their ex ante estimates of things. So science is about guesses and estimates and, you know, thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis. And that if you have a fixed mindset and you're not very neuroplastic, you don't have the ability to update and adapt based on new information, then you get caught in a singular type of identity that then becomes extremely wedded to a worldview. And
that worldview typically reflects a state of mind at a period of time. And if you've been through many different experiences, like being in a religious community and then being an atheist, for example, or an agnostic, for example, you get to effectively move into what, you know, the Eastern tradition would call the witness consciousness, or you notice noticing, because you're separating from the ego and you are residing in a place where you can observe yourself. And that also happens when you have great pain. So if you've been through some form of mourning, you have a dislocation from the ego because your normal perceptions are disrupted. Or it can happen when you have success and you have more capital that buys you more time, and therefore you get a change in perceptions. And so my, you know, inquiries around fixed mindsets and then leaning towards extremes or polarizations are related mainly to that way of understanding the world. And so we, you know, where I started to look at the sort of understanding myself and understanding the world was to try to be as objective as possible and to reside in the witness consciousness as far as possible, but understand that there are sort of two sides to the way that we engage with the world. There is through the genetics or through our perception field, which is our five senses, maybe some inherited learning, but let's say our five senses is our genetic field, our perception field. But on the counterbalance side to our that perception input field is the mimetic field of the social collective world that we live in, which oftentimes is really a type of consensus mechanism whereby people outsource their judgments to a wider group of people. And that's how you get religions. This is how you get political structures. And this is how you get meme kings and meme lords and the prophets of Twitter. And so for me, I've been trying to understand as much as I can about the connections between biology, chemistry, physics, and then economics, because economics, in my opinion, is the least, it's the most sciencey of the social sciences, but it is always lagging because, of course, the posterior results are what people look at, and they don't necessarily know the ex ante inputs. And so as we move into a world dominated by information theory and data, we can see how economics effectively is the substrate at which the mimetic and the genetic connect, because economics and money is an abstraction for time in the time-space world, you know, bound world that we live in. And so the information that is now emerging, that we will be able to understand the fitness function, because money expresses a fitness function because you can only spend it once in respect of what do you want to do. And people are extremely highly attuned to that decision-making because they are living in a world of value exchanges, and those value exchanges are essentially determined by the conservation of energy in the Newtonian, human dimension. And therefore, people are optimized for making fitness decisions with time being abstracted now into money. And so I believe that the connections that are going to come will yield a great deal of insight into individual fitness and group fitness, when I say fitness, I mean fitness of decisions. And I fear that if the data, the information is not owned of, by, and for the people, that the technocracy and that the political powers that own that collective insight will use it to affect the perceptions of the electorate. And through the augmentation of the perceptions of the electorate, we will lose free will. So that's sort of how I think about the subject.
It's funny, the topics of conversation that I've been carrying on in the Cibrone podcast for like the last 16 years, for a large chunk of that, you know, in the doomer years, my grad school self, you know, a guy who was in his mid-20s in the 1990s, would have had no interest in any of that stuff. But he would be intensely interested in this conversation. You've mentioned memes and Douglas Hofstadter and E.O. Wilson. You haven't mentioned Richard Dawkins, who unfortunately, I think these days, most people associate Richard Dawkins with just a very sort of shallow and sort of defensive antagonism towards organized religion. But he used to write much more interesting work. And when I was in grad school, I read The Blind Watchmaker repeatedly, and, you know, The Extended Phenotype and The Selfish Gene. So evolutionary thinking and mimetics were very key, you know, to my my early trajectory, I would say, forming my early interests. But you mentioned how...
I think it's worth a quick response on Dawkins.
Oh, go ahead.
So, you know, Dawkins is often credited with inventing the idea of the meme, I believe. And I believe that a meme is a unit of culture. And then there are a whole group of people who follow René Girard, who attribute mimetics to Girard and his understanding of the world. And, you know, what's funny is, of course, that the word goes back to the Greeks, and mimesis is the fundamental idea that people copy people, and they learn through the vector of their eyes and then are informed by the word. And, you know, what everybody needs to understand is that words have power, and that it's what appeals, like you say, what appeals to you at that moment in time, which reflects back on your point about conspiracies and doom mongering, is that those ideas are often right, but they don't allow for the matrices of other things that are happening all at the same time that can change the course of history and change the course of our world. And that oftentimes comes through scientific leaps in knowledge. And I think Wilson calls them cosmic jokes. And, you know, where everyone says, right, physics is solved with Newton. And the cosmic joke is, of course, the quantum world and Bohr and Bohm and Einstein. And so the idea that, and I feel in Dawkins' work and in Grayling's work, which are all amazing and wonderfully insightful to inform thinking, but the idea that, you know, these ideas usually have to other ideas rather than say, actually, we are probably, given we're seeing all of the connections between everything and the oneness of, this sort of takes us back to the ancients and the original religious philosophies, is, you know, it is becoming more apparent that we are one, and that as information becomes more connective, and as we can learn to verify and then trust, and that those verifications can be cryptographically provable, we have a giant opportunity to evolve our understanding and satisfy ourselves with, you know, information that we can believe is true, in inverted commas. And so I believe that most of the issues that are discussed and most of the issues that one reads about are typically going to reconcile, consilience being about reconciling the differing information into a holistic, you know, comprehension. And I believe that that's what will come about and should be owned also with public AI, because otherwise we do run the risk of evolving into, you know, Homo Proteus, and that Homo Proteus, that augmented man, could be augmented through the privilege, explicit privilege of private access to better AI, which does create a super class of people. And one could say, well, that already exists because people have the benefit of capital that provides them with a better education, and a private education usually being better than a public education for, you know, those who have the capital. So I think we're seeing the fast evolving revelations, shall we say, that technology, or Metcalfe's law plus Moore's law, unleashes. And this has been mostly occurring in the post-war period, or accelerating rapidly in the post-war period.
What is Metcalfe's law?
About the proliferation of communication and the ability to communicate ideas at scale effectively.
All right. KMO breaking in from the future here. I think Nick gave a good explanation of Metcalfe's law. I'm just going to flesh it out a little bit. First, reading from Wikipedia. Metcalfe's law states that the value of a telecommunications network is proportional to the square of the number of connected users of the system, N squared. First formulated in this form by George Gilder in 1993 and attributed to Robert Metcalfe in regard to Ethernet. Metcalfe's law was presented circa 1980, not in terms of users, but rather of, quote, compatible communicating devices, close quote. For example, fax machines, telephones. Only later, with the globalization of the internet, did the law carry over to users and networks, as its original intent was to describe Ethernet connections. So that was Wikipedia. Now, this is just an excerpt from peterfisk.com that Google fished out for me. Metcalfe's law says that a network's value is proportional to the square of the number of nodes in the network. The end nodes can be computers, servers, or simply users. For example, if a network has 10 nodes, its inherent value is 100, that is 10 times 10. And I think you've all encountered Metcalfe's law or some formulation of it, just in the example of, if there's only one fax machine in the whole world, it's not really of any use. If there's two, well, that's infinitely better, but still it has very limited utility. You know, there's just one other node in the network that you can communicate with. The more fax machines there are, the more useful and valuable your fax machine becomes. You can substitute mobile phones, or landlines for that matter, or, you know, any number of communication technologies. All right, and now back to the conversation with Nicholas Lyons.
We are seeing, and Twitter is a good example, the ability for people will check Twitter to find out what the news is faster than they will go to normal mass media. And in the previous iteration before social media, information was controlled by very few channels. And so the information that reached people was mainly limited to print media and the television. With the internet, you get effectively the emancipation of information. And, you know, version one of the internet being read-only, version two being read-write, which is user-generated content and social in version two. And in version three, it's read, write, and own in a way that is self-sovereign, such that you can verify and discern truth in a way that is acceptable to all. And so that's what, you know, divides people. That's what creates, it's an inability to know anyway. And when we live in a mimetic world, so I've, you know, talk about post-truth and post-trust. We've been post-truth certainly since 2013-14. And when you're post-truth, people don't have opinions that they've originated themselves. They have effectively articles of information that they post in order to represent an idea that they've aligned themselves with, for the most part. And the reason why is it's a shortcut. It's easier to post an article of somebody else's work than it is to write a long post of what you think. And so it's all part of the conservation of energy. And the conservation of energy is obviously related to economics, because 80% of the population live paycheck to paycheck. And when you live paycheck to paycheck, it affects your stress levels and it affects the way that you react to things and how your hypothalamus, your pituitary, and your adrenal glands, your HPA axis, perceives information and threats and therefore conditions behavior. So, you know, there are, and that's why people like fearful news more, or fear is more appealing than love, because it's visceral. It is immediately starts the body processing and using, again, as Hofstadter says, analogy as the fuel and fire of thinking. And so that's, you know, understanding that how people behave and why they behave in these ways, and then having the data that enables them to calm their fears and to be guided through accurate information or accurate perception. So perceptions control behaviors, and by corollary, misperceptions create misbehaviors. And that's pretty much at the heart of everything. It's at the heart of all human communications. So the better our ability to communicate at scale, the better we should have our world. But the cheaper it is to communicate at scale, i.e. now we're in a world of voice over IP and everybody can broadcast and everybody can speak and everybody can do whatever, then you have a very low signal to noise ratio. And so misinformation and disinformation is also the corollary of Metcalfe's law, which is why people then say, I'm going to conserve energy and I'm not going to pay attention to the news. And then they lose all signal and then they move into an echo chamber.
Which the big tech companies make very easy. In fact, they make it difficult not to follow into an echo chamber unless you're taking active steps to avoid it. And even then you can still fall into one.
Well, that's the power. That's the power of the crowd, of the collective, because you can say, oh, well, you don't have to go on Facebook, but then you can't connect to 2 billion other people. And, you know, that's, you know, it's all connected, right? And the reason why they're able to connect all those people and build network effects, which are really monopolies, is because they have been given capital by venture capitalists who have received that capital from limited partners. And those limited partners are pension funds, endowments, you know, money of from the corporate pension world and sovereign wealth fund world that has the ability to access capital and then effectively enables kingmaking by VCs in Web2 to basically subsidize loss making for extended periods of time to trap networks and then keep them in those networked walled gardens and build very high walls that then become regulated and controlled by the regulator class that sits under the guardianship of the federal government or the state regulators or local regulators. And so, you know, these are the choices that are being put before us: surveillance capitalism, surveillance venture capitalism, and or state surveillance. And that's really ideologically similar to what has existed in previous generations, in just at different scales, based on different levels of communications proliferation. So there's a Metcalfe's law plus some extensions.
Plus a little bit of Shoshana Zuboff, I think. Her name comes to mind immediately when I hear surveillance capitalism.
Yeah, well, she has a very good framework. I like her framework of who knows, what's her framework again? It is
Who decides?
Yes, yeah. Who decides?
And that's a very good, you know, it's really important that people write these books and bring these ideas to the fore. But oftentimes people don't feel the direct impact, and it's too late when they do, oftentimes. But I think we are at a point in time where enough people realize that we're post-truth, and also what has occurred because of being post-truth is a rapid move towards being post-trust. And the post-trust world is a world that needs to be informed by new technologies that empower privacy and truth and ownership of our digital consciousness, I would say. So my viewpoint is that we need a digital declaration of independence, and that that should enable us to issue, revoke, and recover our identities autonomously and be able to use them online and with providing information to duly authorized authorities.
So it's amazing. I think you've used the word cryptographic once in this conversation, but it's pretty amazing that we've gotten this far into this topic and neither one of us has said cryptography or cryptocurrency. Okay, KMO breaking in from the future once again. Before I play Nick's answer to my question, I just want to share something with you or give you some details on something that he's going to reference in passing. You know, we're talking about proof of work and computers, you know, at first just GPUs, general processing units, just, you know, your standard desktop or laptop computer, but later moving into, you know, more sophisticated and specialized devices like now graphics cards and what are called ASICs, application-specific integrated circuits, basically just specialized machines for doing proof-of-work calculations. All of these fiendishly complex calculations being done by computers all over the world, all competing with one another to get the right to mint the next block in the blockchain. Well, the first block wasn't minted, you know, competitively like that because there was nobody competing. There was just one guy, Satoshi Nakamoto, not his real name. And instead of, you know, competing to mint the first block, he just wrote it or hard-coded it, as they say. And, you know, you can look it up. It's basically just columns of numbers and letters. It means absolutely nothing, except over on the right-hand side, you know, out of just the gibberish of these random symbols emerges the message, the times, 03/Jan/2009. Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. And this is a reference to the newspaper, The Times. And this is the January 3rd, 2009 edition. And I'm looking at a picture of the front page. Top headline is Israel prepares to launch ground offensive on Gaza. Over on the side, we've got Michael Sheen, Frost Nixon, and me. Working mums, so that's how she does it. Detox in style, the best spas on the planet. Salman Rushdie, I won't marry again. And then down at the bottom, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. Again, this is 2009. This is the year after the 2008 financial catastrophe. And as you'll recall, for the next 2 years, not just the US government, but British governments and other governments around the world created a whole bunch of new money to bail out the banks. Bitcoin and the creation of Bitcoin is explicitly in response to that bailout. It was an attempt to create hard money, sound money, real money that can't be diluted and inflated into worthlessness by governments and central banks. So that's just a little preparation for you to understand what Nick is going to tell you in his very thorough answer. So back to the interview.
Because I think that everybody always looks at new technologies and they get stuck in the jargon and they feel good talking about NFTs and ICOs and, you know, these three-letter agencies and acronyms that make people feel like they're in the know and make people, other people feel like they're not in the know. And I think that the issues that cryptography resolve are, and the Nakamoto proof resolve, are evolutionary technologies, and they are reflections, and they have the state of the art has evolved in response to the changing environment. And that could be no better evidence than the message from Satoshi Nakamoto in the Genesis block, which is Chancellor on brink of second bailout. That Bitcoin is the response to that action by the Chancellor. And it is the beginning of a meme, or the first real meme currency or meme stock, because it stands upon an idea of inelastic supply that is a direct rebuttal of Chancellor on brink of second bailout. And so I really feel that the technology is a response to the environment, and that it is inevitable that these technologies will evolve. And, you know, maximalists, who should really be labeled fundamentalists, are very similar to ancient tribal religions, in that they have to dispute other in order to know themselves, instead of understanding that we're moving towards greater connectivity, and that the multi-chain connected world is the obvious evolutionary solution. And it seems strange to me that people can't see that, but when you start to understand the rest of the way that I think society and humanity is going, it becomes sort of actually, you know, pretty clear that people are talking their own book and their own bag, because they've invested money, and that money has liberated them in many situations, and therefore they are attributing the money with having magical properties rather than the mathematics, which apply universally, not just to Bitcoin.
So I think that you have used my statements and questions to sort of gauge my level of understanding of cryptography and cryptocurrency and that sort of thing. And I think you've done an excellent job. But these are matters that I investigate on my own much more than I talk about on the podcast. So I think a fair amount of unpacking, at least for the sake of the audience, is in order. Backing up just a little bit, who are you talking about when you talk about maximalists?
Maximalist is the term that I think applies to any follower of a cryptocurrency that believes that their solution is the only solution. It is following that idea of cosmic jokes, as espoused by E.O. Wilson, is to say that, you know, people believe and they stay in the old mindset because they can't conceive of the new or the, you know, the next answer. And the maximalists are the people that say, you know, like Jack is a Bitcoin maximalist, it seems, for Jack, Twitter Jack is a Bitcoin maximalist. Yeah. And so he believes that Bitcoin is the only solution, and that Bitcoin is going to be a hard money solution. And that ignores everything to do with real economics. And it ignores the fact that Bitcoin becoming effectively a gold substitute, hard money gold substitute, is extremely limiting in terms of growth. And we've got massive global growth, and we want more growth for the world. And the world has grown through fractional reserve banking and the ability to loan money. And so, you know, a maximalist adopts a whole suite of thoughts that then reinforce their love of one particular way of doing things. And I think that those are limit, you know, it's a limiting way to approach what is, at the end of the day, mathematics, which would fall into the natural sciences, and therefore should be able to be applied widely and evolved. So a maximalist is someone who has a fixed mindset and particularly has bought into many of the ideologies of a protocol without necessarily seeing the wider picture.
And when very, very smart people, you know, you've mentioned E.O. Wilson repeatedly, the author of Consilience and many, many nature documentaries as well, I think. There's another Wilson who is...
Spiritual Conquest of Earth is another great book of his.
I haven't read that one.
Well worth reading.
But another Wilson that is important to me is Robert Anton Wilson. And he talked a lot about reality tunnels. You know, that was his word for a belief system. He also liked to abbreviate belief system BS.
You know? This is the heart of the conscious agent theory. That's fitness versus truth.
Yeah.
Truth is the stories we tell ourselves. And every human has, you know, their own story. They have, if you look at, I don't know if you looked at the, on my pinned tweet, I have this diagram that is a sort of adaptation of all of these ideas, but I titled it Consilience and the Unity of Knowledge, and it has the subtitle Perception Controls Behavior. And at the heart of Perception Controls Behavior is fitness versus truth, which is the way that we see the world, right? And so, you know, what you say versus what you do. And there's often contradictions in what people say and what they do. And it's those contradictions that we then reconcile into our story and the way that we, you know, say, well, you know, I said one thing, but I did another, right? People do this all the time. So I believe that information will enable us to be more honest with ourselves, which is why when you're doing, for example, a diet and you're logging, you do better because you're holding yourself to account. And the human has, you know, very, you know, good ways of forgiving themselves based on, you know, the environment that surrounds them. And so one, you know, really has to look at the evolutionary elements of fitness versus truth and that having a relationship to a value equation.
A thought that has recurred to me repeatedly over the course of this conversation is that if you live in a very friendly, you know, physical environment that sustains your well-being with very little effort and very little knowledge on your part, you can think yourself quite clever. And you can take your material comfort as evidence that your belief system is correct, when in fact, you know, the flat earth belief system is rapidly growing because of the YouTube algorithm primarily. Just, you know, YouTube has figured out if they want to maximize time on site, one very lucrative and successful method is just to take somebody who's mildly curious about some, you know, some non-standard worldview, and then just leading them down this long rabbit hole into utter, you know, craziness, which has resulted in lots and lots of people who a decade ago just assumed that the Earth was roughly spherical, now believe it to be basically a plate with a dome over the top of it. And, you know, it's like when you're investing in altcoins during the bull phase, you know, and Bitcoin is going crazy and everything else is rising quite quickly, you can make a lot of money and you can decide that, you know, the fact that you've made a lot of money is evidence of your sophistication as an investor. It's like, no, you just happened to get in when all boats were rising with the tide.
That's one of those things that doesn't, you know, it in every realm we have attribution error and confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. And money is one of those, you know, giant, again, money has become this abstraction for people for intelligence or for some superpower. And that's why these people become meme kings or meme lords or presidents. You know, they have an understanding that it doesn't really matter the facts or the truth, etc. It only matters what people believe. So to your original Anton Wilson idea of you know, realities, we all live in our own unique world. We experience the world through our perception field, our five senses. We then process that experience and make a decision, and all judgment is self-judgment. That is reflective of you. So the decision you make effectively is the fitness function. And then we take the next action because we're moving through time. And so the next action is imbued with some form of energy. And the energy is in words or in actions or in likes or in shares, etc. And that imbues that action with energy. That's the mimetic energy, either the unit of culture in Dawkins' definition or in Girard's conception, the mimesis that replicates through the species. And this has been going for forever. And then you feed back to your unique world and you make sense of it through your own storyline, your own narrative. And the more you are trapped in a singular narrative, the more at danger you are, the more you realize that you are many different types of people based on the situation you find yourself in, the more you'll be able to accept, you know, the differing views of others, right? Everybody who's falling into one of these traps is falling in for a reason. They have a yearning because they are meaning-seeking machines to find themselves. They're looking for a reflection. And, you know, this is really what the social medias have optimized for, which is why the format has become shorter and shorter and shorter form and has become more and more visceral, which is why TikTok is winning, because it's the most visceral of the media.
There's a quote that's often misattributed to John Maynard Keynes. I've just looked it up. It's by Paul Samuelson. But the quote is, "When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir?" And there are systems of reward and punishment in our society which make it costly to change your mind publicly.
Absolutely. Not only is it costly at the public level, changing your mind at the individual level is also very costly because you have to reprocess and update all of your priors. So if something, you know, you can be, the best example is you could be a racist and you could hate on people of color, for example, and then you need a heart transplant, or, you know, a better example, a kidney transplant, and or you need a liver match, and the person that saves you is a person of color, that person will not be able to hold that a priori. They will relinquish that a priori. And you see that in people going through these, you know, seemingly Damascene conversions, right? It is because the experience is what enables most people to update a priori. They can't abstract theory until they've had the experience. That is the general way that most people experience the world. Those who can abstract more have the ability to think more different degrees and different levels away from themselves. And so this is, you know, really just the way that people work, in my opinion, and that experience changes them. But it may well be that we can, if we can trust and through verification of information, and we can have better stores of knowledge, that is human knowledge, then we'll be able to actually solve a lot of those problems as well. Sorry to interrupt your thought.
Oh, no worries. My role here is just to give you something to respond to and talk about. So the listeners have many, many hours experience of just hearing me talk to myself into a microphone. So it's a different story when there's another person on the line. You have the priority. Let me invite you to talk about Verus, because you've talked about identity and verification and recovery, you know, of lost identities. So there have been many possible segues into talking about this company.
It's not a company. It's a public blockchain, and it is a protocol, and it is not, you know, owned by any one. And there was no ICO, and there was no VC involvement. It's a true community built protocol technology, like Bitcoin, but an evolution of Bitcoin. And that's when the maximalists go, ah. we can continue to talk about, you know, how this, you know, I think a lot of the thoughts that you're expressing, and it seems to me, you know, unless you specifically want to go into the details, I think that the conversation we're having is really the backdrop to why you need certain technologies. And maybe if people are less au fait with crypto, it might be better to have the conversations around the sort of pillars upon which the technologies we need to have. And I say we need to have, because for me, I don't really care who evolves these technologies. I just want them because I want them to solve problems that we have as a society and we have as human beings, and that could make for economic efficiencies that would enable us to not run into the brick walls like we're going to run into if we don't solve these problems. So if you want to talk at that level first, we can talk at that level. And I don't know also time-wise what you're thinking. So, and I don't know, you tell me.
Let me ask you to make a case for proof of work. First, define it and then make a case for it to a person who, like, for a lot of people whose primary orientation in life is, you know, they are environmentalists, they love the earth, they think that human industrial activity is bad for the earth, and that really the best thing we can do is just minimize what we do, you know, do less, reproduce less, just have a smaller impact on the planet. And for people with that mindset, a very easy sell is that proof of work blockchains are evil. They needlessly squander power and pump the atmosphere full of carbon for no good purpose. What's your response to that?
Okay. So, like everything, there's a micro, macro, and a meta thought. So let's take the meta thought first. The meta thought is that attacking a nascent technology for its relative polluting feature sort of ignores its virtue feature, which is the ability to create permissionless, unstoppable, immutable ledgers of record that enable consilience through verification of the ledger's correct state. Okay, so that's a lot of words. But what it really means is that what is proof of work doing? It is ensuring that we don't have to use centralized entities as stores of information that we consider to be true. So truth is what we're aiming for, and truth via verification. And that verification is done using cryptographic proofs. And those cryptographic proofs are provided for by the use of machines computing resources that enable that process to happen. So that's the first thing that one has to understand, is that this is the purpose of running these machines is to provide a way to enable the post-truth and post-trust world.
So
does that make sense as the first meta point? So it's to say, the question therefore is, if this new way of making sure that you know something is verifiably, provably true, and that you know that the store of that information is the safe and secure, that's the reason why you're running that protocol, the reason why you're using that proof of work. Is that something that...
I understand what you're saying. I'm just going to try to paraphrase it, and you can correct me if I'm missing something, but mostly for the benefit of the listeners who, you know, for whom this is not their hobby.
Sure.
So proof of work, the blockchain is often described as a distributed ledger. It is a record of transactions and a record of, you know, who possesses what, and it is distributed. There are lots of copies of it around, but cryptographic work is done by computers in order to validate that distributed ledger, basically to provide confidence that it is correct in an environment where there are no trusted institutions that just get to say what is true and what isn't.
Correct.
So
if you need, if you believe, if one of your beliefs, so this is exactly about updating your a priori's, right? So if you are in the first belief set that says, I'm a environmentally aware and I want to have something that is environmentally sound, you would probably have a series of other beliefs that should not be dissonant with that belief that says, I also believe that we should have democracy and freedom, and that we should be able to discern the truth, and that the likelihood is that that person who wants truth also knows, if they are conscious and they're a conscious agent, that ultimately who determines the truth is about who do you trust to process that data and to give you that data. Do you trust the government? Or do you trust corporations? Or do you trust your neighbors? And how do you trust them? So now we're going to append to your excellent summary of proof of work, why being post-truth and post-trust requires systems that enable us to determine what is truth and how to trust that is truth.
So there are alternatives to proof of work, proof of stake, for instance, which are far more energy efficient.
So correct. So
why not use them?
Correct. So now we have to say, okay, the generation one that you created, the Satoshi Nakamoto created the Nakamoto consensus, enabling this process using a computer, also understood that originally it was supposed to be able to be run on your PC, but as the network grows, you need and you benefit from, there is an incentive built into the design that incentivizes an arms race, shall we say, to use GPUs and FPGAs, and then to design a custom-built chip, an ASIC chip, that runs the most effective way to run that proof, but it is not energy efficient. That's where the problem comes in for the environmentalist, is that the arms race in solving this algorithm enables an incentive, a perverse incentive, to use energy. Now, the Bitcoin guys will say that the Marxists would say, but we're using hydroelectric, we're using solar, and other forms of money also consume giant amounts of energy. So that's where you start to put it in a different realm, and you start to say, okay, the incentive set up for Bitcoin is perverse, because we know, because of human incentives, that there will always be someone, if there's an incentive to use coal, or if there's an incentive to use some other form of polluting energy, that the individual or the market will mean that people will do it. So that's what the environmentalists should be arguing and say, it's a bad incentive. What can you do as an alternate? The benefit of proof of work, however, is that it enabled, and it's in its first iteration, it enables fairness, because anyone who has a computer can keep a copy of the distributed, decentralized ledger. So it is very fair. And so the reason why people advocate for proof of work is because it at its initial use case in the original Bitcoin use case, it was enabled at the CPU level, at the regular computer level. Now, as it's grown to be specialized hardware with massive environmental needs, it gets away from that fairness function. But that fairness function has a bleed over into regulations, okay? And that's where proof of stake comes in. So we need to understand that proof of work has fairness benefits, it has decentralization benefits, it has distribution benefits, but it has downsides, which is negative incentives as it succeeds. Yeah? And the proof of stake does resolve the issues of environmental issues, but it fundamentally has a problem, which is that stake is essentially investment. Stake is something at stake, having skin in the game, is saying, I am going to put my money into the security of this network in return for some economic benefit. And so this has a weakness, both in regulatory terms, because the SEC and many others would consider that staking is a regulated type of activity, and earning yield could be regarded by bank regulators, as they have informed various DeFi protocols and Coinbase, for example, that lending products are not necessarily outside of their purview by any stretch of the imagination. So the issue with proof of stake is that it favors exactly the same setup that we have now, which is he who has the most money makes the rules. And so one can see that if you have more money, you can buy more stake, which means that fundamentally, it's not as fair.
So I think an explanation of what proof of stake is and how it can stand in for proof of work is necessary. I mean, it's a consensus mechanism, but how can just somebody who already owns a token or a coin just staking it somewhere, how does that facilitate consensus?
I'm trying to avoid complexity, although everything sounds, when I'm saying it, all sounds so complicated. The best way to think of it is that even in proof of work systems, the work is an exchange of money. The exchange of money that goes on in proof of work is the cost of buying the computer to run the proof and the cost of the energy to run the computer. And therefore, and Satoshi talked about this, there is a rough exchange of energy for reward, which means that you've got something at stake. And having something at stake is how you optimize in systems for minimizing bad actors because bad actors don't want to just throw money away, right? If you're going to attack a permissionless, trustless, immutable network, the reason why you're going to do it is to disrupt the chain of truth. That's what's being stored, is an immutable record of truth of that chain, whatever that chain is keeping a record of, right? And so there is energy as an abstraction for money in proof of work, in my comprehension of it and in this explanation. And the same applies with stake. It is an exchange of money in backing the longest chain of truth that dissuades bad actors from coming with their own money to try and augment that chain of truth. And therefore there is something at risk. There is something at stake. And that something at stake dissuades rational market participants from trying to allege that another chain is the chain of truth, because the purpose of doing this is to effectively steal the value or destroy the value of the information that is stored therein. And I think that's the way that, you know, we can go into all of the, and everyone's got different ways of doing things. And then you know, we could go through a sort of never ending array of different ways that
Contained within the vessel of like the last 10 minutes, not going anywhere new, but just making things clearer from right. where we are. So
proof of work and proof of stake are ways that you can incentivize and dissuade rational economic participants from misbehavior. And the way that you can cryptographically and computationally store those proofs in a way that makes them censorship resistant, so that you can have trustless, permissionless networks that enable peer-to-peer exchanges of anything of value. That's what it enables. So that's why you have to join the two thoughts together. You have to say, okay, proof of work offers us fairness and distribution and decentralization, but it lends itself to perverse incentives and an arms race of equipment. Proof of stake, it lends itself to scaling and lends itself to better eco-credentials, but it doesn't offer fairness and it effectively reinforces the existing inequalities that crypto is supposed to resolve.
So let's pause there. We're talking about fairness. We're talking about different ways to achieve consensus. And one of them, you know, the proof of stake basically is, look, I've got a lot of money, or I've got a lot of, say, Cardano tokens, or ADA, and I have staked them.
Just value. Think about it as value. Yes. I have a lot of value, mm-hmm. and I'm going to put my value at risk.
Right. So that's what I want to get at right now, is the risk. The proof of stake mechanism, what gives it weight is the person who is staking, you know, their units of value is saying, I am lending my credibility to, you know, this structure. And if I'm proven wrong, the value that I'm lending to it will be taken from me. I will lose my stake. You know,
it enables consensus, and it incentivizes people to act together to get the reward for being the next block of the chain of truth. It's reward driven.
The person who, or the block, the blockchain that is using proof of stake as a consensus mechanism, the fairness issue comes in that when you stake your units of value, whatever they are, you get more out of it. I mean, you get a return on that. And the person who has more to stake will get more reward. Whereas if everybody is just mining, you know, with proof of work, and nobody is starting with a big advantage, that's where the fairness comes in. You've right. mentioned that, ICOs. That, what is
that,
an ICO?
By the way, that's the missing link that we did not describe, is that the reward for putting your computational power or your staking power mm-hmm. is that you get the reward for being the next block on the chain.
in a way, it's a form of interest, basically.
The more you invest. I mean, people don't like to say it because, of course, they don't want the analogy to traditional finance. But I do consider staking to be pretty much similar to putting your money in the bank and getting interest on your money. You're getting rewards for participating in a software protocol. And that is where to make the difference. So that's the reason why we shouldn't make the say, you know, we should explain it that it's similar, but the way it's different is that because you're running software and software is free open source, software is free speech. It is that upon which the whole, you know, idea rests, is that, you know, it's not the same as being a bank, because we are contributing to a protocol that is, you know, not under the control of any one of us, and that the reward is for the staking or the computational work that provides for a decentralized ledger of immutable, unstoppable, permissionless truth.
So let me ask you to explain what an ICO is and why it is important to you that the community protocol that you're involved with, Verus Coin or Verus.io, symbol VRSC, why there was no ICO involved.
So an ICO is an initial coin offering, and an ICO is really a feature of the Ethereum world for the most part. And the problem with a protocol doing an ICO typically is that it bleeds over. And again, this depends whether it's a token offering or whether it's a true public blockchain, but that there are questions of fairness in the ICO process and whether you are in fact might be classified as a securities offering as opposed to being a protocol that is running open source software that is decentralized and distributed. So the ICO word is mainly associated with the Ethereum world, and it is where people effectively said that they were doing blockchains, but they were really just doing securities offerings using tokens. And then there was some egregious fraudulent behavior. And in many cases, there were a lot of people that, you know, raised money and they really believed that they were going to do things, but they were not offering technology that was usable. It was a future promise that was dependent on the efforts of the party that was launching the ICO. And furthermore, they usually allocated themselves a large portion of the founder rewards, or they allocated themselves a large portion to other associated entities, foundations, etc., which were all really designed to get around securities legislation rather than to be true public infrastructure. So we make the point, the protocol makes the point that it didn't do an ICO. It was fair launched. It is a pure protocol. It does not pay founder reward. It did not give developer reward, etc. In order to establish Verus's credentials as a true open source public blockchain, public infrastructure that is rent-free and did not have the origins of either Ethereum, which is centralized, and that's what Jack's been, you know, making clear. It's a, whether it's VC-backed or whether it's corporate-backed, whether it's, you know, Joe Lubin and his friends from Fortress and JP Morgan, who have a giant influence through Consensus, or whether it's Solana and the Silicon Valley VC chains, the reason why Maximalis or Jack highlights this is because he is right in highlighting the feature of Bitcoin as a pure, not necessarily well distributed, because there are, you know, 10,000 people that own, I think, 27% of Bitcoin. So it's not as well distributed as it might be. and it will create a new, I suppose, aristocracy, a Bitcoin aristocracy. But that's why people object to it, you know, in many other realms. But the point being that ICOs, proof of stake chains, and unfair pre-allocations or pre-mines undermine the credentials of a protocol being suitable for the global community. It has to have those features in order to be appropriate public infrastructure, in our estimation. And other people will have additional thoughts on that. And some people will say, well, yes, you're right. You can start with proof of work like Ethereum did, and then you should migrate to proof of stake. But that ignores, you know, the true antecedents. And that's where people contest, you know, what really happened. And that's where transparency is critical. So, you know, this is a very complicated.
It is. I'm trying to simplify it and not chase, you know, rabbits that have dashed off tangentially from the topic here. Like I won't even begin to ask you about what it means to be rent free. Let's talk about pre-mines. I mean, I want to stick on the ICO. I think most people are familiar with an IPO, you know,
initial public ICO, offering. An ICO is like an IPO, essentially. But an IPO
you don't mine shares of stock.
Say again, you don't mine shares of stock, but most of the offerings are not public blockchains. On, you know, on Ethereum, those ICOs are token offerings. And they have different mechanisms to create, you know, scarcity or minting and burning, etc. But essentially, they're not a public blockchain with its own mining and staking.
For the sake of the listeners, I just want to, you know, put a stake in the ground here for navigational purposes. A coin, a crypto coin has a blockchain of its own. A token can run on somebody else's blockchain. So there are a great many what are called ERC-20 tokens, which are just tokens that run on the Ethereum blockchain. What's the important distinction between tokens and coins?
So now you're asking the right question. So the distinction between token and coin is, in my estimation, that, and I think most will agree, that a coin runs a public blockchain that has either mining or staking that is the way that it comes to its consensus, right? So there is work offered to the community and it can be decentralized and distributed, and it has the argument of its regulatory status as, you know, to be similar to Bitcoins on that basis. If you're issuing a token, then you're going to be subject to the jurisdiction in which you launch that token. And if you're doing that in the US, you will most likely be classified as a security. So this is where, you know, again, it's about a singularity. It's about all of these disciplines coming together, and they are going to need new definitions and new words, which is why you see so much legal work around this, where you've got the infrastructure bill, which is touches on this. You've got the securities legislation that touches on this. You've got the derivatives regulator. You've got the commodities regulator, because you're dealing with all different forms of value: security, commodity, currency, derivative. These are all words that describe different forms of value that are governed for differing reasons by government that has a reason to regulate these for consumer protection in some cases, and they would argue in securities, and for protecting the dollar hegemony in respect of currency. And so the arguments for doing a public blockchain would be that you have the shelter of free speech, and open source software as a form of free speech that entitles people, if they can, to exchange value peer to peer without needing a middleman. And that middleman is, to go back to the last point, which you didn't want to get into, the middleman is the rent seeker. The middleman is the one that charges you 30% or 20 to 30% on Apple's store, is the Google tax of 24% for every consumer packaged goods company that wants to gain the attention. That's the middleman, that's the rent. The rent on Google is 24% of budget costs. The rent on Apple is 20 to 30% of costs, same in the Play Store, et cetera. On Amazon, same, 15 to 30%. And then, you know, every marketplace in, you know, the property market has a 6% in America, a 5 to 6% tax on transactions, because you've got to pay the brokers 2.5% aside and then the other title insurance, et cetera. And so every single marketplace where there's an aggregator or a network effect or a monopoly is where a tax is taken. And the aim of proof of work, proof of stake, decentralization, distributed, you know, ledger technology, is the whole idea is to have public accounting and the ability to trade peer-to-peer any form of value that anybody wants without any boundaries, that without any jurisdictional boundaries in terms of if you want to send money anywhere in the world, if you want to do any of that, if it's peer to, if you can do it peer-to-peer, then the question is, why shouldn't you be allowed to do that?
So I have two podcasts, and it's been my understanding that we're recording this conversation for what I call the small room. This is the Cibrome Vault podcast. This is just for paying subscribers. I wrote down the phrase protecting the dollar hegemony, because I think that would be a great title for the publicly available podcast. And I would love to talk in a later conversation about the contest between cryptocurrencies generally and the US dollar, and, you know, by extension, the US government.
Well, I think that you have to abstract it further again into a framework of micro, macro, meta. The meta game is essentially China, the Western liberal, democratic, Europe and America, let's say, and then individual states with individual inputs, like the Russians and the Middle East, et cetera, which are involved in the energy complex, right?
I'm going to ask you to stop. I would like to leave that whole topic for our next conversation.
Sure.
And just ask you to sum up the importance or the takeaway points of the conversation that we've just had. I think a lot of people, not a lot, some of the audience will be disposed to take a very negative stance to any talk of crypto at all. Another segment of the audience that I have to apologize to understood everything the first time, and all of my attempts to halt and rephrase and simplify things have been annoying to them. And, you know, my apologies. But I think probably the largest portion of the audience are folks who are interested, open to the topic, but possibly scratching their head about, you know, what's the point? What have we been talking about? And I would just invite you to focus in on the needs of that group and summarize. What have we been doing here?
Right. Okay. The aim of all of this is to appreciate that in a world that is accelerating through Metcalfe's law, communication improvements, that is, and Moore's law, computational improvements, we are barreling towards the unity of knowledge, which is represented by the word consilience. That unity of knowledge, however, needs us to be able to discern the truth. The question is, how does one discern the truth? And how does one ensure that we can trust those that are holding repositories of truth, whether that truth is how much money is in the economy, how much tax is received? It doesn't matter. It's just information that we need to know is true, and that we need to be able to trust that the source of that truth is accurate. So problem is discerning the truth. The solution is to build a network of trust. The question is, who do I trust? And that could be, do I trust the government, Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon? Do I trust anyone? Do I trust my neighbors? Or do I even trust myself? So the solution to that is, don't trust, verify. And you do that, how do I verify is the next question. Well, the solution is with technology, but what technology are we going to use? Who owns the technology that we're going to verify who we trust and what is the truth? And we say to ourselves, you know, is it centralized? Can you be deplatformed from that technology? Because that obviously wouldn't be good. So we say, well, we need a publicly owned solution. And so a publicly owned solution says, oh, well, that sounds good. But the problem is how do we compete having a publicly owned solution if, you know, everything is offered in the existing system for free because there's a freemium model that is being used by the technologies that we have come to trust? And we say, well, we do that by creating a network effect and a network economy. And we do that through the use of these new technologies, these proof of work technologies or proof of stake technologies, or in the case of Verus, we have a hybrid proof of power, which is 50% proof of work, 50% proof of stake. And we say, so what we have enabled is a new network economy instead of a monopoly network effect that can be owned of, by, and for the people, and governed through fair protocol technologies that enable us to exchange any form of value peer-to-peer, whilst we can also use intermediaries if we choose, but enable us to send anything of value in the digital realm, and that ultimately it's a recognition that we are merging, and we have been merging with technology, not in the way that people are talking about, you know, embedding chips and Elon's Neuralink or whatever else, just, you know, just the use of the mobile phone and carrying that around and having a camera and having a video and having GPS and having all of these things that attach us to a digital footprint. Those digital reflections need to be new human rights that enable us to have a digital declaration of independence so that we can monetize and protect our privacy and our societies in the digital realm in the same way as we fought for all of these years to evolve our freedoms and our democracies in the physical world. And so it is that combination of very large trends that is coming together, that some people call the singularity and some people call, you know, coherence, whatever word you want to use, or I would call consilience. It is the reconciliation of information and the desire to ensure that that information is accurate and that that information is private, and that it can be shared and used to build the next evolution or the next chapter of our human future.
I think that's probably a good place to leave it. That was Nicholas Lyons, and Nick will be back. We'll do a conversation for The Big Room, the publicly available SeaRealm podcast. We'll do that in early January. And if you have any responses or questions or comments that you would like to inject into the conversation ahead of time, well, being SeaRealm Vault subscribers, you are in the know and you have my ear. So, you know the drill. Send me email, kmo@seaRealm.com. Post comments to the episode notes for this episode on SeaRealm.com or over on Patreon, patreon.com/KMO. I guess that's it. You know, unless you were to employ some more esoteric technology to get a message to me, but email and posting comments or, you know, direct messaging on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, those are your basic options. They're pretty reliable. Now, they are controlled by big corporate behemoths. They can punish, they can deplatform, they can do it algorithmically so that no human being had to generate any mean thoughts in the process of doing harm to individuals. But if you're expecting a rant here at the end of a 90-minute long podcast, well, go to YouTube. Lots of KMO rants there available on YouTube. Or just hang out here. I've got another conversation lined up with Jim, your ad attacker. Remember, we discussed, what's his name? Last name Sandel, but the book is The Tyranny of Merit. Well, there's another book on the problems inherent in meritocracy. And Jim has read that book. I have merely listened to a long interview with the author, but we are going to discuss that topic tomorrow. So I'll get that out to you probably on Sunday. So thank you very much for your patience with my long silence as I relocated from Vermont to Arkansas. I'm now in Arkansas. I'm not entirely moved in, but I've got a workspace set up, and it's time for me to start cranking out material for you and for the readers of the Geb webcomic. Geb is a slow-moving story. My pace of productivity has slowed on that as the pages have gotten more complex. And, you know, at first it was in black and white, and then there was some spot color, and now it's moving to being a more of a full-color presentation, which takes a heck of a lot longer. And that's not to excuse my own inactivities when it comes to just sitting down on a regular basis and drawing the damn thing. But new location, new routines, new motivation to work hard and stay focused. All right. And for anybody who pays attention to global weather, there was just a great big storm in the Philippines. I was out of communication with Rose, my long-distance girlfriend who lives in Cebu, and I heard from her finally today. So she has electricity and internet once again, and we are back into our pattern of twice daily communication. All right, that's all for now. I will talk to you again very soon, I promise. And until that time, stay well and Merry Christmas.